Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 15th of September. Our guest this hour says, in referring to the war in Iraq, we've reached a moment where Americans might feel comfortable walking away from this thing as if it's over, but it's anything but over. We're seeing more and more evidence that it's moving into American communities, and we're going to see the effects of having more than a million soldiers in that country as they return home. David Finkel is our guest this hour, National Enterprise editor of The Washington Post. He's been with the paper for 20 years, has reported from most continents and many war zones, as well as for its foreign staff division. He won the 2006 Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting for his case of the U.S. government's attempt to bring democracy to Yemen. In 2007, he was embedded with U.S. soldiers during the surge in Iraq and wrote a book about his experience that is considered one of the ultimate books about war. It is very, very well done, very hard to read, but beautifully written. It was published in 2009, and we spoke to David at that time about his book, The Good Soldier, which has been hailed for its intimate look at war. David is with us the first hour of our program today. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and the email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, David. Thank you for being with us again.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, great to have you here. Well, let's talk about those who have come back to America and whose lives will be forever altered by the horrendous experience of being in war. What does it mean for us, and how damaged are the more than a million soldiers returning from Iraq?
Yeah, those are the questions. I think what it will mean will become apparent as time goes on. It's still rather early. What you had read in the beginning of the show, it's an opinion of mine, but it's I want to note it's opinion based on what I'm hearing from a lot of soldiers who have come back, and for some reason, because of the tenor, the tone of the book I wrote, The Good Soldiers, for some reason, soldiers feel comfortable emailing me and telling me what's going on inside them, things that they're not really sharing with their family, with clergy, with other people. And the second part of what you asked, yes, over a million people served, and I would imagine that most of them are doing just fine and will continue to do fine. But there's a significant portion of that population not doing fine. This was a tough war, and there's a lot of psychological trauma that's beginning to show itself in all kinds of ways as the war goes from Iraq and back into American communities.
Mm-hmm. And is it a peculiar kind of psychological trauma? It would seem to me, of course, having not experienced war at all or fighting, that having to have that experience in your life would forever shake you up. Is there something peculiar about Iraq that presents a special set of psychological problems?
Well, it's a good question, but a tough question to answer. This is a new generation of soldiers, for the most part. It's hard to do comparisons with people who fought in Vietnam and earlier wars. There's always been some percentage of the fighting population that's had a difficult time after any war, which just makes sense if you think about it. Was there something peculiar about this war? I know from my time during the surge in Baghdad, having spent just about a year there with the soldiers, this was pretty unrelenting tension. And as these soldiers went from young men who felt they were invincible and full of eagerness and kind of a naive optimism, and became degraded by the experience of being in a war, became at times cynical and bitter and angry and the rest of it, that's where a lot of the trauma took root. Took root. And what are the things we're seeing? We've heard about the signature injuries of the war, PTSD, traumatic brain injury from getting rattled around from so many explosions. What that means ultimately, who knows? There's an aggressive effort to figure it out, but it's in the early stages, Kathleen.
Mm-hmm. And you remind us that the average age of the soldier is 19 years old. It seems like such a child still in many ways.
In some ways. At the same time, who else is going to go eagerly into a war?
Right.
When you reach a certain age and you have certain knowledge, it's pretty tough to do.
Yeah. I think there were so many memorable passages of your book, the going through somebody's medicine cabinet and finding all the pills that one of the soldiers was taking to lessen anxiety, be able to sleep without nightmares, probably for pain.
Well, what I'd like to, if I can take a minute, and perhaps this will help solidify what we're talking about. This is an email that just came in from one of the soldiers mentioned in my book. I'm going to leave his name out because I've not asked him for permission to share his name. But I think what he has to say, which he hasn't shared with too many people, is significant. And if I can just read
Please.
From the email, would that be okay?
Of course.
He writes, "I've had a difficult time understanding my place in this world since I got back. When I joined the Army, they said I could do any job, and I picked infantry because I wanted to see the true face of war. I wanted to see and feel what was filtered through so many voices, pens, lenses, and people. I got what I wanted, and then some, more than I could ever imagine. Over the past 2 years, I've dealt with some strange physical symptoms that no doctors have been able to explain, and that's the easy part. I abused anti-anxiety drugs, painkillers, and alcohol to numb my feelings. At one point, I overdosed on Valium and was hospitalized. While there, had a breakdown and had to be strapped to the hospital bed with leather straps. I've spent time in a mental hospital. I've been in a padded room. All of these things never crossed my mind when I was signing that contract with the government.
Mm.
I deal with constant nightmares, anger issues, and any time I go to a public place, I have to know what everyone is doing all the time. Just going out to dinner with my wife is a chore for me. I have to constantly assess everyone in the restaurant to determine if they're any kind of threat.
Oh my God.
They taught me so much, they just didn't teach me how to turn it off when I got home. And that's just touching the surface.
Mm.
So, my friend, the war has not been kind to me."
Whew, that kind of knocks you out, doesn't it?
Well, it does. And it's so, yes, it's anecdotal, but I get an awful lot of emails that echo the same sentiments.
And I guess the question that I have for you is there enough science around, or is war such a horrendous experience, and you were there for a year, that you can't heal those wounds in any way so that you can fully function again, that it forever alters you?
Kathleen, there do seem to be some credible efforts going on to figure this out. Well, now, for the next book I'm working on, which has to do with this very topic we're talking about today, after the war, the trip back to some kind of normalcy for some of these soldiers. One of the people I'm spending time with is someone very high up in the Pentagon, in the Army, who has taken this on as his own personal mission to try to remove the stigma of psychological trauma among the troops, to say that PTSD is a real thing, that the rising number of suicides is approaching a crisis stage and has to be dealt with. And so he is taking it on seriously and convening meetings and doing everything people in the Pentagon do to try to figure something out and get the word out. But it's an open question how much of this, if any of it, will filter down to the ground level where wars are actually fought.
Mm-hmm. We, of course, had the scandal of not enough treatment, not enough beds, horrendous conditions a couple of years ago. Have those conditions improved? Are there more people who are attending to those who are suffering from experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, I think you're referring to the Walter Reed story,
right,
in the Washington Post. And that had to do with not initial care for physical injuries, but aftercare, continuing care. And everything I see and hear about suggests that things are much improved for soldiers and Marines and other troops who are dealing with long-term physical injuries. But it's not the case with psychological injuries. It's sporadic at best. There are guys I'm in touch with, both in the military and then out in the VA system, who are getting world-class help, but there are just as many who are getting awful help. It's just egregious how bad some of the counseling sessions I've attended with soldiers can be, and the quality of care they're getting when they finally reach the point. I mean, this is an extraordinary thing, especially for an infantryman, to ask for help because of a mental condition. to go in and ask for help, and at that moment be treated so poorly that he leaves thinking, I'm done with this. I'm not going to try again.
So what do we need to do?
Yeah, that's the question, huh?
Yeah.
It's a complicated system, especially in the VA, because a lot of soldiers and ex-soldiers, I'm sorry, live in places where it's just awfully difficult for the VA system to attract top-notch doctors outside of urban, thriving, vital areas. And so for a soldier to go back home to a rather depressed area and need psychological help and ask for it, again, it's spotty. Sometimes they'll get good help, but very often the help's not so good.
You mentioned suicides, and I know that there is concern. Do you have numbers? Is there a substantial increase among Iraq vets who are committing suicide? And we've also heard terrible figures about divorces and family breakups.
You know, the Army issued a pretty hard look at itself, a long, like a 350-page report, I think, last month. It deals with a lot of it does deal with suicide and the numbers, the increasing numbers, and what can be done about it. And one of the interesting findings, I thought, was that a lot of the suicides taking place are taking place among soldiers who haven't deployed yet or who have deployed once. And the conventional thinking is that the suicides tend to take place among soldiers who have had multiple deployments and just are worn out by what they've seen. At the same time, if you dig a little deeper into the numbers, it does look like the increase in suicides that's so concerning to everyone in the military comes from that subset of population, the multiple deployments, the people who are a little older, have a lot of economic and other forces against them, marriages falling apart and the rest of it, and they reach the point where they simply can't live anymore.
Hmm.
But the numbers. And I think this is true of the current numbers, but at least last year, exceeded the rate for the general civilian population, the numbers per 100,000 in the military, for the first time, at least in a generation or maybe longer, have exceeded the civilian rate.
You, David, probably saw things, well, I know you did, that you never thought that you would see in your lifetime, and you were there for a year, so you probably saw some horrendous things. And, of course, we're reporting on people who were killing and becoming undone. Did it affect you at all? Do you think about that time?
Oh, sure I do. Every day. Again, part of it is because of the stream of emails I get. But part of it is just being in the midst of it. And as you said, seeing these things and absorbing them. And let me point out something awfully important. I mean, I was there as an observer. And I wasn't there in any way as a soldier, and I can't pretend to know what a soldier goes through. I can know some of it, but totally no, because I didn't have to carry a weapon, and I could leave. I could take breaks whenever it was getting to me. Every month and a half, I could leave the war zone for a while and do some reporting somewhere else and refresh myself. And then at the end, and we might have mentioned this the last time we talked, but when I came home, I had the luxury of spending 11 months writing this book, which was quite cathartic and helped me make sense. More than chronologically, it helped me make sense of what I had seen these soldiers go through. So it was cathartic to sit and consider the thing day after day. And the soldiers, of course, don't have that luxury. They come back and they move on to the next thing without much of a chance for reflection.
And when is your next book coming out? You're writing now.
Yeah, I've just begun reporting it. It's going to be a little while. It's a tough book. The first one was, I confess, it was physically scary. This one is getting into some pretty tough psychological territory. It involves one or two soldiers from the book I published last fall, but it's basically it's a new group of people who are affected by one soldier at the center who's having a very difficult time making the journey back home.
And here you could have done eating around the world, but then again, you couldn't because of what you've seen and who you are.
Well, if they're what. One way to look at this book, I guess, is if if there are a million returning soldiers, if there are a million vets now, and a lot of them are having different degrees of psychological trauma, the cluster I'm writing about is representative of what's going on in so many communities in so many states across America.
David Finkel is our guest, the first hour of our program today. You may recall, because if you haven't read the book, it's an extraordinary book that really gives you a sense of the horrors of war and the very young people who were fighting in Iraq. David is now working, as you heard him say, on another book about what has happened to many of them, and many of them are not faring well. After serving in Iraq, he is National Enterprise Editor of the Washington Post. His book that has been so highly acclaimed and is such a moving and important book was published in 2009. It is titled The Good Soldiers. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. Now that we have officially ended combat operations in Iraq, there are a million, more than a million soldiers who have served there who will be suffering some major traumas. David outlined some of those. There are also 50,000 troops still there. I'm interested in what David thinks about how they may be faring and what their roles are right now. To your phone calls in just one moment. Our email, our phones are filled. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, and keep trying. You'll get through eventually. It's 1-800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David Finkel, our guest, and we go to Kingston and Larry for our first call. Hi, Larry.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have an idea that what we could do with the soldiers coming back. I think we should go right into our neighborhoods in the inner core of our cities and start a program where we rebuild our neighborhoods with volunteer retired tradesmen and having our young soldiers that are coming back. They could train and motivate young kids on the street, and in this way, they could the soldiers coming back, who are used to working a lot, could get integrated, you know, with a regular life again, and help build the neighborhoods. You know, this would be an awful big idea, and it would take a lot of people, but I think you could block off like a quarter mile of a neighborhood and start there. And you'd have to have social services, you'd have to have nurses, you'd have to have training instructors, cooks, medics, police administrators, but start to rebuild our inner cities with these young men.
Okay, David.
Well, it's interesting. I had two thoughts while listening to Larry. The first is these guys coming back could be amazing role models. I've seen people from the worst of circumstances who have gotten into the battalion I was embedded with, and in that battalion, because of a sense of mission and discipline, they really became extraordinary young men and came back extraordinary young men and could be role models. Now, I've also seen the other thing, guys who were great to start out with and became so degraded by the time they came home, they couldn't do anything of the type. But the other point for Larry and others to consider is this is a country on constant war footing, and when these guys redeploy, when they come back home, it's not to do anything but take a break and start getting ready for their next deployment, presumably to Afghanistan. So it's not like there's a lot of downtime where they could go into communities and do what Larry's suggesting. Unless they leave the military, and that's another thing. But when they come home, it's basically to take their 2 or 3 weeks, visit family, and then come back and start training for the next thing.
Isn't that hard to imagine, to come home and then go again, and to come home and then go again, for those who are facing all of these deployments? When you come home, It would be nice to just come home.
Well, during the surge, the economy was falling apart, beginning to fall apart, and there were a lot of guys over there who, despite what they were going through, when they realized they didn't have a lot of options back home, there weren't jobs waiting for them. They weren't going to go to a community where there would be a lot of offers for somebody who might have completed high school and then just graduated and joined the military. What they would do instead was re-up. They would re-enlist, because the deal over there at that point was, if you re-enlist while you're in Iraq, you could get bonuses, cash bonuses, up to, I think, $30,000, and it would be tax-free if you joined while you were in Iraq. So a lot of guys, I mean, the re-enlistment rate was, even in the midst of all that, was very, very high. And once guys did that, then they're signing up for another 5, 6, 7 years. Some in the battalion I was with, some stayed in the same battalion, which has since redeployed to Iraq and come back. Some have gotten out. Some have moved on to Afghanistan. It was an amazing soldier who was wounded, badly wounded in Iraq. And I met up with him at Brooke Army Medical Center outside of San Antonio. And he was so intent on rehabilitating himself to get back and keep fighting. And he was successful. I mean, this is a guy with a partial amputation. And he rehabbed and rehabbed and went to Afghanistan. And then a couple of months ago, a suicide bomber walked up and he died in Afghanistan.
And why did he want to go back? Why did he want to keep fighting?
Well, I think he said what a lot of people say. He loved being in the military. He loved being in the Army. Even as bad as it got for him and for his buddies in Iraq, there was also something about, you know, the old canard about you're there for the guy next to you.
Right.
Well, that infected all these guys. And when they came back, what they wanted most of all, in some cases, not all cases, but what they wanted most of all was it's the most loving feeling between soldiers in a battle zone sometimes.
A true brotherhood, or brotherhood and sisterhood, yeah.
It's a fair way to put it.
Yeah. Thanks, Larry, for your call. We go to Jane from Rice Lake next. Hi, Jane.
Hi, Kathleen. I'm the daughter of a Korean War era Marine and the ex-wife of a Vietnam Marine. And Semper Fi hurts us, too, the wives and the daughters and the mothers and the sons who are left behind. And we have the same stigmas. We haven't been through the traumas, but we have to live with these people, these beautiful people. And it's always it's the Semper Fi thing, you know, it's drummed into them, and it's integrated into who they are. And in my situation, the people I loved, you were going against the core to say that you were damaged by what you had been through. I have nothing else to say.
Well, Jane, first, thank you for your call, and you're exactly right. The stigma runs deep. It still does. And the fact that more attention is being paid at the upper levels to psychological trauma, to things like PTSD, doesn't mean that that's working its way all the way down to the grunt level. And there's still a lot of suspicion. When a soldier, during the surge anyway, during my time, when a soldier complained. Well, there were two things going on. First of all, when he complained of perhaps not being psychological fit for battle, there was often a bit of suspicion. Well, is he just trying to get out of something, or is this the real deal? On the other hand, for a soldier at that time to go down to the aid station and to walk down the hall toward the sign that said combat stress, he knew what he was doing. As soon as he walked in the door, he basically felt he was stigmatizing himself for the rest of his career.
Jane, thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Janice from La Crosse. Hi, Janice.
Hi, good morning, Kathleen and your guest. I'm just, first of all, I'm a pacifist. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. You're okay. A pacifist.
I'm a pacifist.
I heard that loud and clear.
I'm also a woman. I don't see that many women going to war. I have to put that out there always. But I just like why we don't spend this time and energy that we put into killing and destruction, putting it into helping people, building up lives. Because now, you know, justified war is okay. Civil War I, World War I and II. And if you see Ken Burns' documentary, I feel like it should be mandatory for any, quote, military man to see it, because you'd never go there. You just, like, this is horrible. War is hell. And now we get the same thing, same repercussions. These guys come back. They got all kinds of psychological, you know, physical, mental, emotional problems. You know, we go through the same thing, except that we didn't do much over there except destroy a lot of people's lives, you know, dump billions of dollars in there that we don't even know where they went to. So, I mean, the whole thing is ludicrous to me. And that's not taking up, you know, away from people's lives, but I'm just saying, why the heck don't we do something constructive and help people? And there should be no war today. In the 21st century, we should have learned to get along with people, to work for peace, not war. And there's nothing good ever comes out of that. Thank you.
Thank you for the call, David.
Well, yes, I agree. Thanks for the call. As far as her comments, it's a controversial war, as they all are. And if I turn it to the opinion of the soldiers, excuse myself from this, but to the soldiers themselves, do they think they accomplished something? Well, some do. Some came back from that very difficult period after losing brothers in arms, after seeing their very closest friends suffering physical and mental injuries. Some of them came home and thought they had accomplished something, but many more, at least in that battalion from that time, came home wondering what exactly they did accomplish. Not that they didn't accomplish anything, not that it wasn't worthwhile, but it's not clear to them. It wasn't clear to them yet, and it's not clear to them now what exactly they were able to accomplish. It's one more question that I would imagine if I were a soldier, I would be wrestling with for a long time. What was that? Was it worth it? It's just like the email I read earlier. You know, this is a guy who volunteered to be in the Army, but he didn't quite know what he was getting into, and he doesn't quite know what it means, except that he's not feeling very well.
Yeah. I would imagine, although it's hard to imagine all of this, that it would be quite a different feeling. And the only war I can think of is World War II, that when you came home from that, you knew you were fighting a great evil in the world and that it had to be stopped. And you came home and there were parades for you and you maybe didn't talk about it and you suffered from what you saw. But maybe you felt better because everybody was behind you?
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, I've certainly read accounts and books that suggest that. But I also wonder if somebody had poked and prodded a little more. Perhaps these guys would have said, well, it's a little more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm. I was struck by something that my father, who was a World War II vet, said to my son when he was dying, actually. He talked a lot about World War II, and he told my son that if this war is going on, when it's time for you to be an adult, and if there's a draft, I want you to go to Canada. I thought that was, he certainly had never expressed any sentiment like that at all in his lifetime. It was just quite striking.
Yeah, yeah. When I speak about the book, one question I consistently get, there's always a mom in the audience who wants to talk about how her son wants to go in the military, and what do I think about that?
Mm.
As if I could answer it for a family. And it's always a difficult question because in any parent, I mean, I'm a parent, but in these moms especially who seem to show up at my talks, there's such worry, not only about physical injury, but to repeat the phrase again, about the psychological effects, the lingering effects of what But at the same time, you know, they know it's at least generally an honorable profession, and there is an eagerness in these young men, especially, to want to go in and be part of this thing. And yes, they change, but that's every war of all time, right?
Right. Here's another email, or our first email, perhaps. These just make you cry. I'm a returned vet with deployments from Afghanistan and Iraq. When I first came home, about 6 months after my first deployment, I began having troubles. Nightmares, car accidents, bar fights. When I went to the VA, I was told by the civilian who worked there that I was embellishing my stories, and he didn't believe me. I left with no intention of returning. My answer was to return to the combat zone. Now I am home, diagnosed with severe PTSD, but I don't know where I fit into American society anymore. This has become my deployment. Being in America is a consistent war to me.
One thing I've found, Kathleen, my discussion with the soldiers I'm now writing about is there's a lot of guilt that these guys are dealing with, and not guilt over something that they might have done. The guilt is more subtle. There's one guy in particular who was a great soldier. Acknowledged to be one of the very best soldiers in this battalion I was with. And he had to leave. He had to leave before everyone else because he couldn't do it anymore. It was a bona fide, verified, absolute bulletproof case of severe PTSD. And I wrote about him in the book, and I've been in touch with him ever since. And he is just so consumed with guilt some days, not because of the honorable way he acted as a soldier, and he was honorable. He was one of the good ones. But because he left his guys early, and what do they think of him, and what kind of soldier is he who would have to leave early?
Let's go to Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Kathleen. Thanks for doing this show. Thanks to both of you. There was a book, and it's not a new book. It's been out for a couple decades now, and it's called The Sharp End. And what the author in that book deals with says that basically what we know is post-traumatic stress is nothing new, that there was, they called it battle fatigue, they called it shell shock, World War One, they certainly were documenting it, World War Two, obviously. And the military was very concerned and studied this, and what their conclusion was that everybody has a breaking point. You don't know exactly when it is, but the one thing is for certain, you stick any individual in combat long enough, and at some point, it'll be too much, they will break. Everyone will. And what is difficult, I think, worse about the Vietnam and the Iraq and Afghanistan wars for the soldiers than even World War One or two, is the uncertainty of the enemy. In other words, those guys who go through that are so constantly under stress because it's not exactly like, you know, oh, yeah, there's the Germans, they're the ones out there in the gray coats on the other side of the field, that's who we're fighting. No, you're walking down the street, you don't know who you're fighting, and anybody behind any door could blow you up. So the stress and the potential for this is so unbelievably heightened, I think. And then you put yourself in this position where, with the volunteer army, it's not like, you know, you go in, and the guys in World War II, they were in and they were exposed, and then it was over. These guys, as you talk about, they recycle. So these guys who were doing the Iraq tours over and over again, well, not just guys, but these, you know, men and women who are doing the Iraq tours over and over again, they're back now. Where are they going next? We know it's going to be Afghanistan. And when I was hearing about this recycling people over and over like this, I was thinking, I thought back to that book, and I thought, oh, aren't they just really, really, really going to keep pushing these folks till they get to the breaking point? And who else is going to take over? Because this is the army we've got. It's not like you're drafting all, you know, the whole population and saying, yeah, we're all going to suffer this. It's a very small percentage of this population being asked to do, of our population being asked to do this over and over again. How could we not expect this?
Yeah, Scott, that there's a dozen really good points in what you said, and you're exactly right. This was not a predictable war in terms of knowing who the enemy was or advancing toward a line or anything like that, as we've read about in previous wars. Anybody could be considered the enemy, and on a particular day, anybody was the enemy. And for these soldiers, the pressure was pretty relentless. I've not heard of that book, The Sharp End, but I'll look into it after the program. But a book I read recently is called The Road Back. It's the sequel to All Quiet on the Western Front, and it's not nearly as famous as the first book, but it's a remarkable book, and this goes back to World War One and guys coming home and just trying to deal with what they've been through, who they became, what they saw. And it's another reminder, although a beautiful reminder and a horrible reminder, that everything we're talking about today has existed in any war, which is another way of saying it will exist in every war going forward.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Scott, so much, as always, for your call. What about the soldiers who are there now? What do they have a clearly defined mission? And they're not combat forces, but they could be combat forces.
Well, a lot of them, not a lot of them. If there are 50,000 or so troops left, I think a couple thousand are special operations forces, which is a pretty aggressive posture. And even if they're going out in conjunction with Iraqi forces, that's an aggressive stance. And we can call them what they want. We can say major combat is over. We can say combat is over. Iraq is not a good country at this point, and there can be arguments about whether it's better than it was. I think another way to look at it is to take the Iraq that exists today and compare it to a couple of hundred other countries around the world, and it's not a good place. There's daily violence. It's a country where there were a couple of million refugees, and this is the middle and upper middle class, and the upper classes, people who could get out, got out to Syria, to Jordan. Within the country, there were a couple million more internally displaced people who left their homes, and so now who's left there exists in a country where there's daily violence, political instability, only a few hours of electricity a day. Nothing's settled there. It's not a good place. And so we have 50,000 troops still there, and they may be on the perimeters of the city. They may be in advisory roles, but they're still in a place that's quite violent and unsettled.
Joe from Milwaukee. Hello.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure, Joe.
And never have enough of these conversations. I'm an Iraq war vet who served with the Scots National Guard, and I was fortunate that I only had to do one deployment. And a few points, basically just to kind of reiterate, I guess. Number one is the suffering that goes on, at least what I felt when I was there, was the people that you leave behind, the daughter and wife of the Marine from Rice Lake, the pain that they go through can't be underestimated. Especially when you have guard and reserve soldiers who are expected to continue to be husbands and fathers and wives and daughters, you know, on one day and then be a soldier the next day and alternate between that, you know, for multiple deployments, that the families suffer regardless. Just another point, I guess, is my guilt, just to share this, is that my sacrifice in the year I had to spend in Iraq was not as great as that of others. Hmm. That I I served. I did everything that was asked of me. I served honorably. I was a medic for a infantry platoon. I was a line medic. So I was there with my guys every day on every mission. And I spent as much time outside of the wire as anybody. But we were extraordinarily fortunate where no one in our platoon was ever injured. We got hit a lot. We got blown up a lot. But nobody ever suffered any injuries. And so my job as a medic was null at that point. Although I became more of a, I guess, a morale booster to the platoon than actually a physical lifesaver. I was more of there to know that everybody, that they would be taken care of if something did happen.
Joe, let me interrupt a minute. You're saying any guilt you feel is over the fact that you were there or your deployment, it wasn't as tough as other deployments?
So to speak. And just our lieutenants had a great way of describing our experience was that he said either God is watching out for us or God has absolutely no confidence in our abilities because we went through as much as anybody else, but no one was ever injured. You know, we never felt that we were in the what they call the security and stability operations, where we were there right at the beginning of the insurgency after the OIF-3, actually, is when we were there. And, you know, so we were at the beginning of the winning the hearts and minds, so to speak, after the initial invasion and the beginning of the occupation, for lack of a better word for it.
Well, it's this I ask because it's a point I've heard again and again. You're repeating something I've heard, and I'm glad to hear it from you. The battalion I was with, they went back and they had forgive the phrasing, an easy time of it. There were some incidents, there were events, things blew up, but a few scratches here and there. I don't think any Purple Hearts and. So that was the deployment when they went back again, because it wasn't entirely the same group of guys. Some moved on, and probably a little more than half of the battalion was made up of new guys who hadn't been part of the surge. And so the new guys would say again and again to the old guys, "You're so lucky. You know, you got to be here for the real war, the real violence, and we're missing it." And the old guys would say, "You have no idea what you're talking about."
Yeah. Oh, thanks, Joe, very much for your call. Our phone number and our guest, first, let me remind you, if you're just tuning us in, is David Finkel. David is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and editor at The Washington Post, and he is the author. It has been described as, if you're going to read anything about what the war in Iraq is really like for the people who are fighting that war, this is the book that you should read. It is The Good Soldier, written in 2009. Finkel spent 8 months from January 2007 to June of 2008 with a battalion of 800 U.S. Army soldiers from Fort Riley, Kansas, known as the 2nd Battalion, 16th Infantry Regiment of the 4th Infantry Brigade Combat Team, 1st Infantry Division. And he covers this story so thoroughly and poignantly as well. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. We have quite a few very lengthy emails, which we will post on our Facebook page, and we will send to David as well, because he's currently writing another book about what's happened to soldiers after they've come back to the United States. So I'm sorry we won't be able to get to all of those, but we will send them his way and post them so that all of you can read about what people are going through. And there are also mentions of some programs that may be of help. More phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Before we go back to phone calls, David, considering the fact that the economy is in such terrible shape, unemployment so high, What is the employment picture for those vets who have returned? Are we making jobs available to them in some ways? What kinds of jobs are they, because they're so young with high school educations, are they able to walk into? Do we need work on this front?
Oh, I think work could be done on this front, Kathleen. Again, it's I hate to use one guy's story to stand in for everything, but it's quite a story. It's one guy who's come back and served honorably, is having a bit of a difficult time. He's out now, so he's out of the Army. He wants to work. He keeps reading that if you've served in Iraq, if you're a vet for a lot of programs, you automatically get special consideration. And I don't know, he emailed me the other day just with the latest batch of rejections. 50 jobs, 50 turndowns, and that's pretty much his story. And he says the story of a lot of his friends. Good guy. Capable of working, wants to work, has a job. It's not a very good job, and he keeps applying for better things and is hoping he would get some consideration because of his veteran status. But so far in his case, no luck.
And I would think that as we talk about the morass, the depression, et cetera, for those of us who have never served in war, work can be a godsend to us. It keeps us going. Work is a very important part of our lives and would be helpful, I would think, in dealing with some of the issues, unless they're horrendous for the
right.
people.
Right. Well, that just makes sense to me. Any kind of stability,
sure,
sense of worth, it can't be a bad thing for anyone, right?
Exactly. Beth in Richland Center, hi.
Good morning, and good morning to you as well, David Finkel, and thank you from the bottom of my heart for the wonderful work you're doing. I'm a facilitator together with several of my colleagues. We are offering our services to veterans and their families, and some of us are offering very liberal sliding scale fees, and there are some pro bono opportunities as well. We simply are not willing to wait for these men and women who have become warriors with the high ideal of caring for us, their fellow citizens. We're not willing to wait for them to get their needs met when they return and need us to be here for them. I would like to give the names of the two major websites where people can find useful information, veterans and their families. The first is EFT4Vets.com. I'll spell that. E as in Edward, F as in Frank, T as in Tom, 4, and that's the word F-O-R-V-E-T-S.com, where you will find a lot of information, including a link to a movie, a DVD called Operation Emotional Freedom that has been just a real godsend for several vets and their families already. And you will get to know this brilliant and wonderful woman, Ingrid Denter, who is doing a lot of work and has a deep understanding of the warrior culture. I highly recommend that anyone interested get in touch with her. And the second is personalpeacefoundation.net. And the point person there is Sophia Kayer. And if anyone would like to get in touch with me personally, I'm at Facebook, and my name is Beth Baker, and I will be more than happy to do everything I can to make referrals to any vets and their families who contact me.
Oh, thank you so much, Beth, for your call.
It's my privilege. I really care about our vets, and I want to thank every single one of them for the service that they're rendering their country.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for the call. Oh, there are good-hearted people out there, aren't there, David?
Yeah, that's a nice phone call.
Yeah, it is. Well, we're out of time. Thank you for the work that you do. You are an extraordinary writer, and it's so good that you chose what I'm sure is such a hard area to cover, to let us know what the experience is, to fully know what it is. And then to come back, and instead of moving on to something easy, you're following through with something that's equally as hard and important.
Well, it's awfully good of you and your show to keep keep paying attention to the subject, and I'm just glad to be able to talk about this with you.
Yeah, thank you, David. David Finkel, our guest this hour. Many of you, and I think it's probably on archive, if you want to hear the interview that we did, he was with us in 2009 when his book, The Good Soldiers, and it is an extraordinary book and well worth a read if you want to know what it's truly like to serve in Iraq. He was embedded with a group of very, very young guys who experienced great trauma and who were quite brave. And it is an extremely moving book. And now he's working on what happens when people come home. And there are many who have come home. So the war really is not over. David Finkel is editor of the Washington Post. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Thanks for your calls, everybody.